Six music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time, where we look at those key moments that have made some of our most important artists who they are, be it their first gig, the first time they picked up an instrument, or their first hit record. And this week we're honoured to be in the presence of not only the singer of one of the most iconic bands of all time, but also the man behind some of the most original and distinctive albums in recent years. A truly unique talent and an all-round hero. It's true to say there is only one Ian Brown. Let's start things off with, what was the first time you were even aware of music as a little kid?
When I was 5 or 6, and my auntie gave me an old Dansett record player with a pile of 7 inches, about 10 Beatles tunes, few Stones, Supremes, It's Not Unusual, Tom Jones, and I got that little pile when I was 5 or 6, and I've still got them.
You've still got them?
Still got them.
That's a pretty good broad grounding straight away, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. And they were great Beatles records, you know, Ticket to Ride, We Can Work It Out, Can't Buy Me Love, Help, Hard Day's Night, I'd Get Off My Cloud, The Stones, and I had a Jimi Hendrix Smash Hits, the album. That was the only album I had, which was superb. Like, I didn't really get into that till I was about 11 or 12. It was too spaced, too far out for me when I was that little. I liked the Beatles then.
And it made an impression on you straight away, those
records?
Yeah,
totally, yeah.
First record that you actually bought?
It was Metal Guru T-Rex 1972, and I bought it the same day as I bought Come and Feel the Noise, Slade. Yeah, it was 9.
What was it about that record that you loved?
The energy of it, and the groove, great groove, that I loved it. And then I remember seeing him on Top of the Pops, thought it was great. And I bought Solid Gold Easy Action, I think it might have been the next one, and I bought 20th Century Boy. And I wanted Children of the Revolution, but I didn't have enough money, obviously, as a little kid.
Yeah.
you saw Bolan and people like that on Top of the Pops, was there a kind of inkling of, I want to be doing that?
Not really, I don't think. No, I just loved the energy and what they were doing. I didn't really have any ambitions to do that myself at that time. No, I didn't.
Because there's a lot made of your kind of punk roots as well. What was the first gig you went to? Was it a punk gig?
Yeah, it was the Drones and the Stranglers at Manchester Apollo in 77.
What was it like?
Fantastic, amazing. People pogoing, it's brilliant, really cool.
So that was kind of the gig stuff. But, you know, you've always had a kind of love of club culture as well.
Yeah.
What was the first kind of club nights you started going
after to? After punk, I got into Northern Soul. And we used to go to the all-nighters up in Blackpool and Rotherham and Doncaster, Southport. It was about 16, 79. Northern Soul all-nighters. Used to love that, all that music. Tommy Hunt and Too Late, Larry Williams, Johnny Guitar Watson and...
Proper Talcum Powder on the floor.
Band of Gold and all them old tunes, yeah.
about that. I gave her my heart, she only used it. She took my love and she abused it. You gotta find a girl that will treat you right, that'll give you plenty of loving every night. Now
that's what I told
you and your new love, keep on keeping on. By myself, don't need no woman to help me starve to death. Can you dig it? Hey Watson, dig this. This is what I told her. I don't want no one who don't love me, who keep on dishing out misery.
You don't want nobody that don't treat you right.
Were you a good dancer?
I won't say I was a great dancer, no, but, you know, I used to get involved. Yeah, we used to all dance then, you know. We used to go out, little crew, was we all used to dance, yeah. I wasn't like you see on the old film, so, no.
Oh, the legs.
Nah, I wish I was.
So moving on, we have to talk a little bit about the Roses. When was the first time, pre-Roses, that you met John Squire? Can you remember that first meeting?
Yeah, it was on the fields near our house. We were probably about 7 or 8.
As young as that?
Yeah. I didn't actually hang out with him until we were about 14. But I knew him because he lived up our road. And, you know, we used to have them 30-a-side football games, didn't you, when you were kids? So we would have been part of that, but I wasn't actually hanging with him. But I remember meeting him when he was a kid. He says I was naked at the time in a sandpit, but I think he was exaggerating that one. I don't remember that.
What were your first impressions of him?
He had really big eyes, massive eyes, like Marine Boy. Remember Marine Boy? That's an old cartoon, and he had big eyes like Marine Boy.
I remember that with the gills?
Yeah. Yeah, and he used to swim on that dolphin, didn't he? A white dolphin he had, didn't he? It was French-Japanese, that, wasn't it? Do you remember that show?
Early manga stuff, really,
wasn't
it?
What a show it was, yeah, yeah, it's mega.
So the Roses kind of came together at, what was, I mean, as individuals, what was that first rehearsal like when you all started playing together? Can you remember the very first rehearsal?
I can remember the very first rehearsal, yeah, before Rennie joined. And then I can remember the very first rehearsal when Rennie joined, and that's when it all completely transformed. Suddenly, we had someone in the room who could actually play a groove, and he never used tom-toms, he just used to use a snare and a side tom and his bass drum, and he made it sound like he had 10 drums and 8 arms. So he played like Shiva. He was amazing, yeah. No, Ganesh. He was amazing.
And from that first rehearsal, what was the atmosphere like in that room?
Yeah, just vibes, electrical vibes, yeah, just buzzing like, oh, great, we've got a drummer. We'd auditioned a few guys, drummers, and they weren't all that. And then he just walked in the room and was like, straight away, like, we just gelled and he had a groove and that was great. It was like, I've got a groove now.
Was it like that in the first sort of recording sessions you did?
No, the very first rehearsals, we were just sounding really basic, sub-punk rock. We couldn't really play and we didn't know how to write songs. We just wanted to be in a band then at that time.
What was the first song that you really thought that you'd, as a group, you were like, that's it, that's the sound, yeah, from the heads?
I Want to Be Adored in 85. We had a little break from the rehearsal and I was just telling my son the other day that we wrote I Want to Be Adored in 20 minutes and he didn't believe me. I was like, yeah, mate, 25 years old, that tune. It's been going for 20 years. We wrote it in 20 minutes in a little break. In 85, John picked the bass up and he did boom, 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 boom. And I just sort of sung it all out, all in one go. Don't know where it came from, just sung it all out in one go. You know, there's only 6 lines in that song, isn't there?
It's only 6 lines?
There's only 6 lines and that's it. And we just kept it like that and just repeated that and then did I Want to Be Adored Again at the end. And then what you hear now, you know, he took away and he worked his guitar out. But the basic bones of that we did in 20 minutes in 85. And then, you know, he took the bass off, showed the bass player. That was before Manny. It was a guy called Pete Garn on the bass. Showed him the bass line and Rennie picked the beat up and the tune was there then.
Yeah.
Because that first album is still, I mean, people still hold it up like some kind of, you know, it's this untouchable part of music history. Do you, I mean, some people don't always have a great...
I'm not going to stop him.
Because some people don't have a good relationship with kind of like the kind of the one record that kind of started their career. Some people kind of find it quite difficult to talk about it. What's your relationship like with
that album? I love that album, you know, I love it. Put my life into that album, you know. I've seen the pleasure of, you know, half them songs were written in 85, 86, you know, This Is The One, Made of Stone, Waterfall, Resurrection. They're the big tunes on there, and they were all done in 86, which was 3 years before it hit, you know, hit the shops, 3 years before that. Lyrically, I really love it. It's like a call to arms, lyrically. No, I love it. I'm really happy about that album. I think it is a great guitar album.
Music.
BBC Six Music.
Thank you.
I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time with Ian Brown. I asked him what he remembered of the initial crowd response at the unfilmed, legendary, near-mythical Stone Roses gig at Spike Island in Widnes in 1990.
As the crowd jumped up, 30,000 while we were on there, it was on the sand and there was a load of dust. It's like a massive dust cloud, giant dust cloud. You couldn't actually see anyone for about 3 or 4 minutes until the first song was finished because of the dust. Kicking up the dust, 30,000 heads. That's what I remember, yeah.
So when did you realise that the Roses were over? When did you realise that basically the band...
Actually, I left in 1993 because I wasn't digging it, as they say. And John Manny taught me back into it. And I've got no regrets, but I could have started solo a little earlier. I suppose when I walked in, I'd just seen a big mountain of white powder and I thought, oh, yeah, we're that now. We're one of them old dinosaur bands that, you know, we came up through punk rock. We were supposed to be against all that cocaine rock. And that made me think, wonder how long we'll last. And it was about a year after that, did a world tour, that was it.
So you mentioned that you left before. When did the idea of becoming a solo artist sort of start? When you first, you know...
Actually, no, not at all. I remember doing the Geffen deal in 91 and the lawyer said, oh, he said, give me another half an hour, he said, because they've got some terms in the contract that I don't like that pertain to if you're going solo. So I'm going to improve those terms. And me and John were like, forget it, it's never going to happen. Don't waste your time, leave it. He said, no, it'll only take me half an hour and I'll get you a good future solo deal if it runs. And we were like, forget it, that ain't going to happen. It's this or nothing. That was in our mind. And when the Roses finished, you know, because it finished and the fact that we'd finished that and we were sort of worldwide loved, but I was skint, I was back in my mum and dad's, back in the bedroom that I'd grown up in with my brother. I thought, wow, that's music, you know. I had a go and that'll do me. Right. And I wanted to do something pure and simple and I wanted to grow flowers then, actually, like my granddad had done. You know, little piece of land like the size of a penalty area. Grow a bit of, you know, grow some flowers, take in the market, you know, get a bit of money, buy your dinner. Dead honest, dead pure, dead simple. The opposite end to the, you know, crazy music business. And that's what my heart was set on. I actually, you know, got to digging my back garden over and planning, you know, do I do dahlias or tulips, you know. And I just kept people coming up, like, all the time, you know. And this kid says to me one day, you're Ian Brown, do something. And I thought, yeah. I'm still young, you know what I mean? And I locked myself in my box room. I went to B&Q, I got a load of that rock wool, you know, soundproof panels, put it all around the box room in my house, covered a load of carpet over it, spent what little money I had at the end on equipment. I got a Jupiter 8 keyboard, an SP-1200 hip-hop drum machine, because he told me that's what the early hip-hop was done on. I got a Fender Strat bass, a Fender Strat guitar, a Fender Jazz bass, and just sat in for 6-9 months and did my first solo album that way. And I loved that because I didn't have a label, I didn't have anyone, and I was able to finish that on my own and then take it around the label saying, you know, this is the finished article, do you want to release it? And I started on that and I'm still here doing that on my own terms, you know, and that's the only way I could do it, really.
So we've talked about your decision to go solo. What was the first song you wrote? You've got your home set up now. What was the first solo track that you can remember writing?
Solo, yeah, My Star. My Star.
That was the first one?
Mm-hmm, yeah, My Star. I wanted to write a song about what I saw as propaganda, these US astronauts get the kids into space because the astronauts are heroes, when actually the astronauts all come out of the US military. They used to fly fighter jets, and I believe that the US space program is a military front. So I wanted to address that in a song. I think it's disgusting that they spend, you know, trillions go to the moon and there's ghettos on the earth. It's just not right. So I wanted to, you know, I sing satellites to destroy the poor. So on the record, I wanted to get that message out. Godspeed, John Glenn.
Space exploration, for nuclear stations, NASA corrupted, Jurassic doctors. Space exploration, excursion to stars, on a military mission, on a military journey to Mars. I'll see you in My Star.
Were you happy with the way that it was received? Because people love that.
Oh, mate, you went straight in at number five. I was flipping elated. I was levitating. That's when I first learned to levitate that week.
It must have been lovely after all the grief and being confined by people's expectations of the roads and
yeah,
the money
completely,
and the hassle.
Totally. All that, you know, baggage and all of that, you know, shenanigans. Suddenly I was number five in the chart, fresh, and it was my own work. Brilliant. Answer to nobody.
I remember seeing you on Top of the Pops. Was somebody playing the eggs?
Yeah, that was Wiz who did the video. He'd always had a long-held ambition to be on Top of the Pops. He said, come on with me. What do you want to play? He said, I want to play the eggs. See what? He said, I want a tray of eggs and I'm just going to, like, pour them. I was like, all right, go on then. You want to do come on then. So that's what he did.
Aziz Ibrahim was a big part of that record, wasn't he?
Aziz wrote the guitar lines on that, yeah. And he played the bass also, yeah.
When did you first meet him?
I met Aziz with a friend, Robbie, who replaced Rennie on the drums, Robbie Maddox. And I met Aziz at his house, and Aziz was like this amazing guitar player. I think he was showing off to show me what he could do, but wow, he could cut it. So he came and said, you know, why don't we write some songs? I said, yeah, let's do it. So we wrote My Star and we wrote Corpses. And that was my second single.
And that was like, you always found that quite a fruitful kind of relationship, haven't you?
Yeah, definitely. We worked well, and yeah. And he's been on a couple of albums since then, yeah.
In 1998, you spent 4 months in Strange Ways.
That was my first time in jail as well, and hopefully my last. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, it's. I suppose in the context of this, do you remember the first time? What was that first night like?
So noisy in jail. You can't believe how loud it is. You know, guys groaning, and then you'll hear someone, you know, you know. People shouting threats to each other or just screaming and shouting and so loud, and also you're so hungry. You know what I mean? The food is, it's worse than dog food, and you just got that permanent hunger rumble in your belly the whole time you're there. You're just like starving hungry.
So what was the first thing that you did when you got out?
When I got out, I went to see my mum and dad first thing, and took them for a steak. And at that time, I'd not had red meat for 11 years. I'd had no red meat at all 11 years, and I just had a pang for a steak because I was starving, and I took my mum and dad out and had a steak.
Golden Grapes was your second record. Really sounded like you were enjoying yourself at that point.
Yeah, definitely, because I came actually out of jail on the Christmas Eve, and I went straight to my home studio at home, and I did Love Like a Fountain. I did it all on my own, the beats, the music, the groove, you know, lyrics and melodies. Hummed a bass line into a mic because I can't play the bass that well, and then got a player to play it me. So I was elated because, you know, I'd done 8 weeks in jail, come out, now I'd Love Like a Fountain. About 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, Christmas Eve, finished, went to bed, got up. I'd had a load of lyrics that I'd done in jail. I did Free My Way, the song Free My Way, and I had the vocal melody in my head. I had the beats and the sort of idea for Dolphins and Monkeys. And they set my baby free. It was a letter that my girl had sent me in jail, set my baby free. Thought that's a great start for a song. So I kind of had like a quarter of the album sort of half there from that experience.
You've said before that Love Like a Fountain is one of your favourite of your songs. Was that the first time where, similar like you sang with the Roses, with the One to Be Adored, was that like the first time you were like, that's exactly...
Well, yeah, you see, you know, like I say, I never had an ambition to go solo, but then once I'd made that first solo album, I was happy. That was it, you know, I was happy. Just get that album out, and that's me done, happy. And that went in at number two. It was actually number one all week until the Titanic knocked it off on the Saturday morning, and that's no shame. The Titanic's the biggest selling soundtrack of all time, still. And so that then just like, really gave me the confidence to think, wow, I can make another one, you know. And I got into it. And so, obviously I was delayed with me staying Strange Ways, but actually it ended up aiding some of the tunes that, and that got me hungry, kept me hungry, you know.
There's that on that record. In fact, on all your records, there's this dub kind of feel to a lot of the stuff that you do. When did you first get into reggae? Because you've always talked
reggae.
About.
Yeah, since I was 14, it was punk rock that got us into reggae. You know, a lot. We used to go to the Russell Club. We used to have a lot of matinee shows, like the Buzzcocks and the Damned. Used to play to like 14-year-olds, under 16-year-old matinee show on a Saturday, and then play at the over 18s. Then and there, in 77, there really weren't that many punk rock records out by the summer of 77, so they used to play a lot of reggae. They always had a dread playing the reggae, and there was that album 2-7's Clash was out that same year in 77, and Prince Farai, he was out, Dr. Elementado, and a lot of the musicians like Rotten and Strummer, they would talk about reggae in their interviews, and you'd find things. I got into Elementado through Rotten interviews, and I got into Prince Farai through Clash interviews. But again, you know, being in Manchester, reggae was big, so we used to hear it at the punk rock shows then, and I got right into reggae then, in 77, and we used to spend like school dinner times at my mate Martin Hahn's house, playing them albums, 2-7's Clash, and Best Dressed Chicken in Town, Black Uhuru, and all that. I've loved reggae since. I love all the reggae, right from Trojan, late 60s, right through that 70s roots reggae, right through to Sizzler and computer reggae now. I love all reggae. I love the message, and I would say reggae is the highest form of music. It's God's music to me, reggae. It's the highest thing music can be, is reggae. I love the singers. I'm not really into the dub. I like the singers, me.
As each record kind of progressed, I mean, Music of the Spheres, you know, you've got a song in Spanish, they start to feel more international influences. Was that kind of an intentional thing to kind of...
Well, I married a Mexican, and I went over and did a couple of videos off the Golden Greats out in Mexico, and that made me think I want to start doing some mariachi horn type music, which eventually I did with Time Is My Everything, and I've done a couple of similar things since. So that was probably the Mexican side, and my wife, you know, influenced me. But also, you know, I started travelling, you know, go to Japan every year, and Australia, and all over.
You've done a lot of work with Dave McCracken as well. He's kind of become your kind of...
Yeah, my man, yeah.
Sort of studio guy. What was it like the first time you started working with him? Was it an immediate link?
Yeah, well, I did me Unfinished Monkey Business, and a pal of mine said, what you're trying to achieve, you need a programmer, because he'll make it even smoother and tighten it all up. You know, I was going straight to 24-track tape. So I said, I booked a studio, and then I said to him, do you know any programmers? And they said, yeah, the Red Hot guy at the moment, this is 10 years ago, is Dave McCracken. So he came in, and I had the beat for Dolphins and Monkeys and the lyrics and the melody, so he laid it down, but I didn't have any music. I just had the singing tune, the lyrics and the beat. And then Dave said, oh, you need maybe a keyboard to be good on this. I said, well, what, you know, what we got? So we get, and he comes up with the keyboard line, Doom, 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 doom. I was like, whoa, that's brilliant. I said, right, who's your publishing company? Then we'll have to sort that out. He said, no, no, no. He said, I'm a programmer, you know. I said, no, that's composition, that. He said, well, no. He says, you know, I've worked with all these acts and I do them bass lines and I do them keyboard lines, but, you know, I'll just get a programmer's fee. I says, yeah, but if I was to get a publishing check for that, like 100% composition, that wouldn't be true because you've done that keyboard line and that's now the music. So I'm going to make you a co-writer on it. Which he argued about because he was like, no, no, this isn't my thing. But I was like, mate, I can't sleep at night and get 100% of that song. I know you've done that line. So that then made him like the co-writer. And now years later, he's just been signed up by Rocker Nation and he's the only English guy been signed up by Rocker Nation. And I just think that's knockout because they're seeing in him what I'd seen 10 years ago. Produced my latest album. I asked him to produce it. He's got a couple of tracks on Beyonce's album. That's how far he's come in 10 years. So he's my man, yeah. And you know, we make each other better. We make each other stronger. We're not afraid to tell each other ideas a week, or that could be better, or this could improve that. And I think that foil, two heads is always better than one. And I'm just glad and lucky that I met him.
Beyonce and Brown, man. You should do a track with her.
Absolutely. There's a dream, right?
Let's talk about the new record. When did you first start work on it?
Actually, it was September the 19th last year. I remember that because I had a look at the CD before I come out with my first work CD. We started the Bones of Stalify September last year. And then we did the writing all the way through autumn, winter, until we got the songs. And then we started recording them in the spring. And we finished July 7th, the day they buried Jacko. Not buried, the day Jacko died.
Because, yeah, a bit has been made of this whole sort of Michael Jackson thing. Because you are a fan of his, aren't you?
I am, since I was a little kid, yeah, absolutely. Jackson 5 were up there with T-Rex and Slade when you were a kid, yeah. And Thriller, if you're into music, you're going to love Thriller, surely. Off the Wall, brilliant album.
For a person that's always kind of followed their own path, kind of My Way, seems like a bit of an odd title, because like every album's kind of you've done it your way. What's the why?
Yeah, I suppose. I never thought of that. I should have put that a word in here.
Why now to kind of state that, I suppose?
Yeah, well, why not? My way, you know, my way, the highway. I never thought of that. You're right. Because I did the song Vanity Kills with Amanda Ghost and Dave McCracken for Kanye for his 808 and Heartbreak. On a brief from Amanda that it was to be a My Way for Kanye, as in a little bit twisted, a little bit not so sure of itself, and it was to make the 808 an Heartbreak. And she was in the studio and she texted Kanye and said, Ian Brown's doing the lyrics, have you heard of him? And he texted back and went, Ian Brown, Stone Roses, hell yeah. And I was like, get in, Kanye West knows who I am, I was glad. And that's how we did that song. But we were late in sending it in. It didn't make the final cut of the 808 and Heartbreak. So I thought, you know what? I'll do that tune for myself. And Amanda telling me that the brief for the song for Kanye was A My Way made me think, why don't I do an album A My Way for me? So Amanda kind of sowed that seed.
So we've had all these firsts and it's now the end of the show, which is time to say as the last thing. What's the last track we should play?
Yeah, why don't you give Man of Man a spin?
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Matt. Thank you. Cheers, mate. Thanks a lot.
Sirens in the mountains, sirens wail on city streets. The heat I radiate shall melt away all icy sheets. 100 million years before the burnout of the sun. Dreams to be fulfilled. Life's still yet to come. It's a failure is your fate, and to succeed is destiny. Place your hand upon your heart and rise above in liberty. I am a man of
The Craig Charles Funk and Soul Show.
Putting a spring in your step and a wiggle in your walk. That is our mission. Mixing up funk, soul, disco, touch of old school rap. We want you to be groovy and funk for the 21st century.
Sad girl.
Go on, turn it up, I dare ya. Put your dancing shoes on, bang your shins. Boom. Boom.
Boom.
Boom.
Boom.
Great Charles Funk and Soul Show every Saturday night from 6.
BBC Radio 6.
Plus, listen to past shows on BBC Sounds.
Knows that I'm right.